This is a podcast of Costing the Earth from the BBC. For full terms and conditions, please go to the website at bbc.co.uk. Now, here is Costing the Earth with Alice Roberts.
Yeah, this is... the paler stuff is the chicken manure, and then the other stuff is cow manure. It's pretty lovely and moist. It's going to go straight into the two polytunnels behind us.
200 years ago, our cities would have smelt something like this, the warm, comforting odour of farmyard muck, proof that most of what was being eaten in the city was produced in the city. That smell and that philosophy is coming back to urban Britain.
Urban agriculture, that's the posh name for it, it's actually food growing by local people using local land, but in cities. And really making green spaces, fantastic spaces where food can be grown, people can come together and enjoy that, get some exercise, also create green habitats for lots of wildlife. It's a transformative thing. It's a wonderful, wonderful project to be involved with. Every city in the world could be growing more of its own food. It won't feed people completely, but it does help people to connect back with their food, to connect back with nature, to get involved with things in their community, to break down the barriers between communities. It's absolutely wonderful.
Kath Dalmini of the London Food Board. 3 years ago, I visited Todmorden in West Yorkshire, where the local people had systematically seized any patch of bare land they could find. They didn't wait for council grants or for permission from the landowners. They just went in, planted their seeds, and invited anyone to come and enjoy the harvest.
You didn't plant it?
Well,
hang on a minute. So this is actually stuff growing here. This is edible things growing.
Yes.
In this plant pot at the side of the canal.
Yes, it's edible things. We don't know what they are. They're some kind of radish, possibly an Asian.
That's why
we don't know what they are.
Yeah, I think it's from that Asian
seed.
They're mysteries.
So who harvests this and when? Or is it just for anybody who comes
along and wants to?
In the summer, it's mainly for boaters. They all park up here. They've got their showers there.
Yeah.
And these get hot, these metal containers. So the deal is, this is full of salad in the summer. They help themselves and then they water. So we have a sign up that says, help yourself and tip some water on.
Salad.
And it works. You see them getting off their boat with a little kettle of water.
Yeah.
It's great.
So you can't get any fresher than that, can you? For the leader of Todmorden's incredible edible campaign, these plots had a propaganda purpose, showing how you could improve your local environment and feed yourself cheaply and healthily from your doorstep. 3 years on, Pam Warhurst has no doubt that her campaign has succeeded.
It was always our plan to build on the propaganda beds that you guys came and saw, places where people can have conversations about what's that growing and what do I do with it and start to reconnect as a community. And since then, you know, we've expanded our propaganda gardens. The one we've got in front of the police station is phenomenal. You know, the inspector there says that community relations have never been better since we've done that, because it allows people to talk to each other, as it were, almost over the garden fence. And environmental vandalism has just dropped because people don't vandalise food. And we have people from all over the world poking around in our beds every time of year, having a conversation and taking it back to where they come from. Just ordinary people. So what it's done is, from a relatively small start, we've managed to spread incredible now to many more communities. And we're starting to see those communities themselves have their own story to tell about building a kinder world.
In this week's Costing the Earth, we're looking at how far urban farming has come. Is it just a fashionable new spin on traditional allotments, or can it transform the environment of our cities and put fresh food on all our plates?
As we go through the kitchen and out through into the yard and then into the alley, you'll see that it's not just an ordinary alley. It has quite, you know, a lot of assets to it.
We'll start in the back alleys of Middlesbrough, where Mavis Arnold and her neighbours are spreading the Todmorden effect.
When you see the sort of start of Coronation Street and, you know, similar, that's very much like how our alleys are, except it's a little bit wider and a little bit nicer, I think, yeah. I'd like to introduce you to my neighbour Jimmy, who is interested in growing and does a lot of the heavy work around at our other garden. Good digger.
Actually, the way I look at it, looking down there now, I can see pagodas, I can see table chairs, I can see little greenhouses, loads of planters down both sides. There's plenty of plants in them, even though, to be honest, it's the wrong time of the year to be looking at it. Mm. But
we have little daffodils and everything coming out, haven't we? Sort of all the spring stuff starting to appear now, so we'll soon have a little bit of colour appearing here, there and everywhere.
Mavis and Jimmy's Alley, right in the centre of Middlesbrough, backs onto 56 homes on one side and 56 on the other. It was a dank and unpleasant haunt of wheelie bins and would-be thieves, but the council fitted gates at each end and Mavis set about turning it into the lush, fertile space it is today.
I like to grow my own produce, which again is just done in small containers, as in a rather large half barrel. And this is sort of, I alternate tomatoes and potatoes. And then I have a small greenhouse that I start off seeds. It's a grow house, really, rather than a greenhouse. And believe me, it's surprising what you can grow in a small container, which I've, you know, proved over a length of time. Herbs, tomatoes, leeks, onions, potatoes, in a very small area. So I'm pleased with the results. Yeah. The tomatoes were amazing. We had tomatoes grown out here, and I didn't have to buy any tomatoes till well after Christmas last year. So, very plentiful supply of tomatoes. Yeah. And the way food prices are rising and everything's becoming so expensive, I think the very fact, even if you grow in a small way, is excellent, you know, towards helping a household budget, getting it very fresh and enjoying it sort of as a health initiative as well.
When we first start on these wasteland sites, we generally find that they're heavily overgrown, so we will have to spend a lot of time getting down to ground level. A lot of times it comes down to even using the old sickle to the scythe to level the ground in times, and people have fun using that. So with a bit of training, it's generally really overgrown. That's the only problem. Once you get down to the ground level, then it's just as much the same as any site.
A mile or two away from Mavis and her alley, the waste ground at the centre of a housing estate at Bexley Close is being transformed by local people with the help of Mark Quinn from the charity Middlesbrough Environment City. Burnt out cars have been replaced by polytunnels, supplying fresh veg to the neighbourhood.
What we're looking at here is we've got one pile of well-rotted manure, which is going to work to break down this organic matter for the soil. So we're going to use, put it to good use anyway. So here we have a hotbed. It's a small aluminium frame that looks like a mini greenhouse. Hotbeds comes from a Roman idea, and it became popular in Victorian times as a way to heat the soil using fresh manure. Then it would give the crops that extra heat they needed to get them through colder spells.
This site is just one of the first patches of waste ground around the area that Middlesbrough Environment City spotted as a potential urban farm. Mark Fishpool is the group's director.
The programme that we've had here in Middlesbrough for food growing has really got a lot to do about people's health and about making fresh produce more available to people, particularly in places like Easterside, where it's not readily there a lot of the time, and a lot of people don't have access to big supermarkets or other sources of fresh produce. So what we're trying to do in a site like this one here at Bexley Close is really generate sufficient food so that we can obviously have some for the people that are working here, but also generate some surpluses that we can get out into the community for sale, which will then enable people to have better access to food, but also will generate a little bit of income to keep the site going. In addition to sites like this, we're also working, for example, with a lot of schools where they're getting more and more of them have got growing sites of their own now, and we're encouraging them to sell the produce at the school gate or in the school hall or whatever, or perhaps at a school fete. And again, it's just helping people, one, to get some food for themselves at very reasonable prices that's as fresh as it can be, making that fresh produce more available, but also making the whole system more sustainable so that the group that's doing the growing is getting a little bit of income, which makes them less dependent on grant funding. They can buy the seeds, the fertiliser, the plants that they need, and keep that going year on year.
This is Costing the Earth on BBC Radio 4. Today we're on the trail of the urban farmers, the people transforming local environments by bringing agriculture back into the heart of our towns and cities. Middlesbrough, like Todmorden, grew up as an industrial town, but now much of that industry is gone. There's no shortage of unwanted land that the local council is happy to see developed. But what about the wealthier parts of the country? Is urban farming really viable where land prices are high?
So what we've got in here is flaming frills and red frills in this bed. Then we've got red chard, more flaming frills and red frills. And then we've got a green crop over there, piso and green frills. Right, next tunnel is...
So tiny seedlings in that one.
Tiny. Piso.
Reasonably sized plants, so are these actually ready to harvest?
The Mizuna's ready to harvest at the end of next week, and the piso will be ready to harvest a week after that. This one, then, we're just re-sowing this one, so this was all harvested. And this tunnel's actually been harvested three times since October.
Really?
What are you putting in there, Pete?
Red dragon.
Red dragon.
It's quite amazing to be surrounded by these polytunnels. I mean, you get into the opening of one of these polytunnels and you think you're somewhere rural, and then you step back out and you take a look around, and we're by these big Victorian bridges in the middle of Bristol. We can see Templemead Station. What was this site? I mean, it's a bizarre site right in the middle of Bristol, but I think one that people just drive by and don't even notice it's there.
Well, the story has it that hundreds of years ago it was a silver mine, which would mean that, when you're mining for silver, there's a lot of arsenic that comes to the surface.
Should I be worried about that, eating your salad leaves then?
No, because we protect all our soil's imported, and it's all on a membrane. It's on a bed of rock, and then it's on another membrane, and then it's imported soil that was tested by Bristol City Council last week.
So historically a silver mine?
First records indicate it was a silver mine, and then after that Brunel used it as a place to store gas, right, that lighted the streets of Bristol. And then it was used as a diesel depot where they filled the trains with diesel.
This site is waiting to be developed into a huge music venue for Bristol, but with a shortfall in funding, the government's Homes and Communities Agency agreed to let the land to Steve Glover. He runs the Seven Project, a rehabilitation scheme for people like him who have suffered from drug and alcohol dependency. It may not have started as a commercial business, but Steve has been building up a large-scale farming enterprise, taking advantage of sites like this one, growing high-value, highly perishable exotic salad crops very close to the market.
Benito, we need some salad for tomorrow.
You want it now?
No, tomorrow morning will be all right. Yeah.
Okay. Now?
Well, yeah, now would be better. This evening would be better, actually. Yeah.
Is that for a restaurant?
Yeah, for the River Cottage.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our new friends, Hugh and his friends.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it is good.
What's the duration of the sowing and harvesting cycle here?
We should be able to plant and harvest within a month. That's what we were doing on the other sites.
Yeah. And where are you selling your produce?
In all the best restaurants.
Are you?
Yeah. I'll show you the list in a minute. River Cottage, Lido, Glass Boat, Canteen, Pony and Trap.
So lots of Bristol restaurants that pride themselves on having locally produced.
We will be producing in a month's time. We'll be producing 300 to 400 kilos a week here. We sell probably in Bristol. We probably sell about 100. Is our record per week. But we also started distributing in Bath, so we'd be looking to sell probably 150 in Bath a week, and then the rest of it goes down to the fruit market, which is no more than a mile in that direction, and then gets distributed round the southwest by one of our partners. We could be selling as much as we can grow.
This isn't a small scale project. This is this is a farm.
Yeah, it is really.
Do you expect it to get any bigger?
On this site, we can put up more polytunnels, and we can put up more lorry bodies. So the lorry bodies can be used for growing mushrooms or micro leaves or germinating stuff. We can put up more polytunnels, but the cost of the polytunnels is negligible compared to the cost of importing the soil. This soil costs us, I think, about £3,000 per tunnel.
Right.
That soil in there costs nothing, because that is subsoil there. So what we've done is we've introduced bacteria to try and mimic what soil would be like in the natural environment. So we've introduced bacteria, we've introduced compost, which we got from when the police bust cannabis factories. They seize all the equipment, they give us all the equipment.
That's fantastic.
So a lot of the compost that is in this tunnel was actually brought by organised criminals.
Right.
or possibly disorganised criminals.
Yeah.
And all of this is new to me. 3 years ago, I'd never grown anything in my life.
So what gave you the idea for it?
We learned how to grow food together. A group of 12 or 13 of us learned how to grow food together. And then we learned how to sell it and how to market it and, what restaurants wanted.
I think compared with some of the urban sites that we've visited previously on Costing the Earth, looking at people growing vegetables right in the middle of the city, the thing which really strikes me about this is the sheer scale of it. How easy is it to get a site this big in a city?
If you wanted to build a multi-storey car park, it would be really difficult because it would cost you an awful lot of money. If you are seriously going to do something that's going to benefit the community and you've got a good plan and you've got a track record that people can come and see, it's quite easy. There's an awful lot of land that is left empty, you know, in particularly in Bristol. And I'd imagine, based on what we've done here, if we wanted to take another site on, then we probably would be able to do that. But you've got to have an exit strategy. It's all very well getting land. Getting land is really easy. It's the easy bit. It's the what you do with the land afterwards and your market. And somebody said to me the other day, and it's very true, and they said the most valuable thing you've got is your list of customers.
You've got to know your market. You've got to know what it is people want to buy and eat.
Your market is the most important thing. And we have fought for our market for the last 2.5 years, nearly 3 years now. We have, you know, got up, frozen our fingers off, dug holes, moved stones, done what needs to be done in order to develop our market. And we have our market now. And now the thing is that what this salad is, you know what I mean, to me, it was the obvious option. Somebody with no horticultural experience, you know what I mean, get them growing mustard.
It seems like an easy option.
We grew cress in school in egg cups, you know what I mean, back in the 1970s. It's the same thing. It's just a bigger egg cup.
The Bristol site is a step up in terms of its scale and its turnover. But like many of the projects around the country, it's not just a food provider. It gains some of its funding and a sizeable slice of kudos from the other things it achieves. So is urban farming ready to take the next step? Could it be more than just the trendy, eco-friendly cherry on the top of our urban diet? Can it be a big, profitable, self-sustaining business? In North America, the urban farming movement is much more established, and in the city of Vancouver, it's a sizable slice of the local economy. Brent Mansfield is from the Vancouver Food Policy Council.
So we're actually talking about growing for profit. And for those who don't know Vancouver, it's a very dense city. We don't have a lot of land laying around. It's like, hey, this could be a good farm. So it's often been really innovative and creative. And it's been a really innovative, creative community that has found different models in which to do that. It can be big or small. It can be a schoolyard. It can be a patio. It could be a container. It could be a derelict gas station or petrol station that we can take over, right? I think there's ways to do that and to realize that that action can be significant in not only influencing our own lives, but also contributing to a better community and ultimately a better environment.
Even in Vancouver, urban farmers aren't coming close to feeding the city. But in a world with a rising population to be fed, he sees the urban food movement as a vital driver of future food production.
People will often come back and say, why are we farming cities? The reality is food needs to be farmed in the countryside. And I say, I agree. But let's not get into kind of either-or thinking. To me, it's both hand. It's all hands on deck. It's where we know it's wartime, dig for victory. We need to do all of it. Right, so let's not kind of make sure that's not happening. And I also know a lot of urban farmers in Vancouver are beginning to take over peri-urban and rural farms. Because in the countryside, I think the same thing is in England as it is back home for me in Canada, is our farmers are aging. So the farming population is not there in the countryside. But people are kind of cutting their teeth in the city, realizing, hey, I want more space to do this. And it's almost like an incubator lab for farmers.
That's where the latest initiative in Britain comes in. Growing Communities has been building up a patchwork of tiny growing plots in East London for 18 years. The vegetables grown are pooled together and sold at farmers' markets and through a local box delivery scheme. It's a model that's small, local and successful. But this year, they've taken on something an awful lot bigger.
Well, I remember walking into this huge glass house and I was with the original horticulturist here, Reg, and I was just completely overexcited about the size of this greenhouse and the potential I could see, and in my mind's eye I could imagine plants growing in here. And I think they'd never seen a woman get so overexcited about a giant greenhouse before. I was virtually having palpitations and I was sort of mentally measuring it up, and yeah, it was a fantastic thing to see it then, and it's amazing to see it now, sort of halfway towards producing a lot of food.
What Kerry Rankin was looking at was the abandoned remains of a 4-acre nursery where Barking and Dagenham Council had once grown shrubs for the borough's parks and gardens. Today, the site is alive with activity as volunteers and paid apprentices help the farmer Alice Holden turn the 4-acre site in the shadow of tower blocks into a food hub for Dagenham and East London.
In this double span polytunnel, we've got winter salad. It's a really valuable crop because under cover it will keep producing right through till spring when greens are sparse. We're selling to a restaurant in Hackney and we're just about to put some into our box scheme.
Alice came to work here after years running mixed farms in West Wales. She's convinced that urban farming projects like this can help resolve one of the big problems in maintaining Britain's homegrown food supply, the lack of farmers. With an average age of 58 and a sharp decline in those employed on the land, there are very few young people like Alice with the skills to transform derelict land like these 4 acres in Dagenham.
When I started out farming, I was just labouring on farms, and I suppose what I thought the end ideal was owning a piece of land, and I've really reworked that vision. Actually, when I didn't ever get close to that, but when I was at my closest point to that, it was actually really isolating, and this kind of community-based growing is far more desirable, I think, because you've got support networks that feed into it. The main difference is the lack of isolation, I think that is something that really gives me good heart, that there's a chance that it might encourage more young people to come back into agriculture, which we desperately need, because also this scale is far less mechanised and relies on people, and it's far more diverse, so it's far more diverse socially, and it's far more diverse in terms of the growing, and that makes it far more interesting. So that I'm already finding is attracting a lot of interest.
Part of the aim of this project, part of the aim of the Start Farm project, is to try and break down the barriers that stop people getting into farming. And those barriers are obviously access to land itself, but also access to infrastructure and capital, lack of access to skills. And with this project in itself tries to address all those things. Obviously, we've negotiated to get the land from Barking and Dagenham Council, but we've also managed to get money from Big Lottery to put in to provide the infrastructure and the funding, initial funding, that's seed funding, because the money will come to an end in March 2014. And after that, Alice has to grow enough produce to sell to keep up her own income and the income of anyone else that works here. But we've also tried to build a trainee element into this project. So we have 3 apprentices who are just coming to the end of their apprenticeship here. And then we'll have another 3 apprentices who will be starting in April. And all of that is passing on skills and hoping that we're actually also growing the growers of the future as well as growing crops. And that's an absolutely key part of the project.
My name's Leon. I'm a Barking and Dagenham resident. I originally started working on the Dagenham site for growing communities as a volunteer. And that started back in May of last year. Soon after volunteering, I was lucky enough to be offered the opportunity for part-time employment here as an apprentice grower, which I was very pleased to accept, and I've been here since. It's surely a personal interest, family. It's been in my family from both sides, mums and dads, and my partner's family, grown-born farmers, and it was just a hobby growing out of adolescence and coming to maturity and realising what I enjoy in life, which was the basics, fishing, cultivation of food, friends and family, just the simpler things. From working with my colleagues, Alice, just being on site, world of information. I've learnt so much, and it's such a large, for this site is not what you would do as a hobbyist. So I've built on my hobby and amateur knowledge, as well as from Alice, who knows the full workings, and from literally from a blank canvas to a full 4-acre up and running site, fully producing veg for sale. You can't help but learn. If you're here, you can't help but learn. If you have an interest, you will absorb from everyone. Everyone has something to offer, and that was a great thing. As I said, you learn from the site, you learn from your colleagues as well. So, wonderful experience. If the space was available, it'd be great to be rolled out across London. It really would. There is interest in boroughs like this, excluded boroughs. I think it's just that people need to be exposed and be informed, and they will reach, they will find what they're interested in. slowly but surely. So, but yeah, loads of them all over the borough, that'd be great.
It's not just about growing food. There are compelling social reasons for doing it too. Urban agriculture clearly has a part to play in rebuilding communities in our post-industrial cities. So now we've reached this scale of urban farming, 4-acre sites of glasshouses and polytunnels churning out tons of fresh veg, can we think about reviving the model from 200 years ago of feeding the city from the city? As well as places where people live and work, could our cities become centres of food production as well? Tim Lang is Professor of Food Policy at City University.
I live in Wandsworth in London. It was an orchard. It grew food for London. It's now covered with Victorian houses and Edwardian houses. Cities almost always grow where agriculture enabled people to live. And so we've assumed with urbanisation that it has the right to take over prime fertile lands. We're doing it again in Britain. It's unbelievable. With the decision by government that it's just going to increase the number of houses, it wants to do that because it's politically popular, there's a very good argument for doing so, but it's assuming we're going to just extend existing cities. So more prime land goes. This is bonkers, completely bonkers. We've got to think about the politics of land. Everywhere in the world has got to start thinking about its own sustainable land use. And at the moment, we just see land as a commodity. If a property developer can bang up a few tacky houses on it, well, that's all right, isn't it? No, it isn't, because it's the land that grows the food that we need.
Demand for food is growing globally, pushing up the price of food and the value of land. Urban farming can't feed us all, but perhaps in the years ahead, we'll be grateful to the pioneers like Kerry Rankin, who've carved out new growing spaces and learned the skills to keep us all fed.
The challenges that climate change presents us with in terms of our food system are enormous. And one of the things we know we need to do is to get more food produced closer to where people actually live. We've got 10 million people living in London. We need to work out how we're going to feed those people. We don't want our food supplies to be extended out across the whole world as they are at the moment. We need to produce more food close to where we are. And so someone like the Starter Farm in Dagenham can do that brilliantly. And also, obviously, there are other projects doing this around London, and we want this to be part of that and to be a model project for what can be done in the future.
That was a podcast of Costing the Earth from the BBC.